Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
You are.
From WBUR in Boston, this is special coverage of the aftermath of terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. As the world's eyes turn to troop movements in Afghanistan, it's the danger next door that keeps strategists awake at night. India and Pakistan nurse a decades-old feud over Kashmir, a bloody history of conflict, and a high-octane nuclear arsenal just miles from Kabul. The United States needs both countries on its side in the war on terrorism, but what will it take for the U.S. to keep regional stability and peace between these sworn enemies, and at what cost? This hour, we're looking east from Afghanistan at the powder keg next door, India, Pakistan, and Kashmir. First, a look at how the West is preparing for war. We're talking with Major Charles Heyman. He's formerly of the British Army and now editor of Jane's World Army publication. Welcome, Major Charles Heyman.
Hello.
Good to have you. Thanks for joining us. Tough talk today from Prime Minister Blair, making it clear that military action is possible at any time. What might Britain's military role be?
Well, I think following Prime Minister Blair's speech, it would look as though Britain is going to give everything it can to Allied forces. Britain has surprisingly, and more by luck than judgment, got around about 23,000 personnel from the Army, Navy, and Air Force in Oman at the moment, just really across the way.
That's as much or more than the U.S. has in the region, I think. Why is that?
It's not quite as much, but it's getting near that figure. And the reason is that there was a very large exercise, the biggest British movement of troops since the Gulf War, planned for about 2 years for now in Oman. And these guys have been moving there now for the last couple of months, weeks and weeks before the terrible events in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Hmm. And there is a sizable force within reasonable distance of Afghanistan, if it's needed.
So Britain has a very muscular presence in the region. How might it be applied?
Well, first of all, I mean, a lot of the people that are there for the exercise may not be the right sort of people who could help out in Afghanistan. For example, there's quite a lot of guys from an armored brigade with main battle tanks and very heavy artillery guns and things like this, and that clearly is not something that looks like being used.
That's more an echo of the Gulf War.
Absolutely. But there are a lot of forces there which could be of great use. I mean, the Royal Navy has got an aircraft carrier. Now, it's nowhere near as big as your four carriers that you've got there, but it's probably now within reach of the operational theater in Afghanistan, the same way as your carriers are. And there's a lot of frigates, and there's a couple of submarines with cruise missiles on board. And there's what we call an amphibious task group. It's got three commando brigade, Royal Marines on board, and they probably, in this sort of conflict, if they were used, they could be used as a raider battalion, a sort of cross between the normal conventional infantry and pure special forces like the SAS.
So that's a lot of firepower. How do you imagine it might be put to use on the ground, in the air?
Well, obviously, the Navy and its aircraft would be involved in airstrikes and as attacks on Taliban targets, the sort of thing that Tony Blair has been outlining today.
We hear again and again that attacking Afghanistan is like pounding rocks, that there's not much to hit there. So what do you do with all this firepower?
Well, it's not quite like that, and I think some people have got it wrong. I think, you know, what we're looking at here is the U.S. and its allies punishing the Taliban for supporting bin Laden and his terrorists. And the Taliban do have military targets. I mean, they've got main battle tanks, they've got armored fighting vehicles, they've got fuel dumps, they've got ammunition dumps for their artillery. And if you take out these absolutely vital military assets that they've got, their chance of survival in the short term is very, very much reduced.
You're saying it might shift the balance of power within Afghanistan to opposition forces?
It will almost certainly shift the balance of power. It will allow the opposition forces to get in. There is absolutely no doubt. I'm very, very rare that I come up with statements like that. But I think in this case, we will see a window of opportunity, I think is probably the best way to put it, for the Northern Alliance and its allies to get in and maybe take over a government of sorts in Afghanistan. But that's a bit farther down the line.
Prime Minister Blair promises victory over terror. What would victory look like? Is that it, the fall of the Taliban? What would it take to claim victory over terrorism, short-term, long-term?
I don't think you can. You can't claim victory over terrorism in the long term. This is a long haul. The best you can do at the moment is look 5 years ahead. And Afghanistan and the punishment of the Taliban and maybe the apprehension of bin Laden, that's phase one of a very long campaign. Phase two will probably then be to turn to other countries that are harboring terrorists and say, you saw what happened to Afghanistan. If you don't get rid of the terrorists yourself, we will have to do it for you. And, you know, this will go on into phase three, four, and five.
Yes, we're told again and again it could be a long war, will be a long war. Are the British people behind Prime Minister Blair in this alliance with the United States? Are there points at which you could see either the British government or people disagreeing with the U.S. military policy or anti-terrorist policy and splitting off?
I think if the U.S. carries on the same way as it has been operating in the last couple of weeks, there's obviously a lot of thought being given into this, and it looks like a terribly measured response. If this is the way that the campaign is to be fought, with thought and care, and possibly surgical strikes, with the recognition that we have to try to make sure that we minimize civilian casualties wherever possible, then I think the alliance will stay on board. And I think here in the UK, it is very difficult to meet a person in the street who isn't behind what Prime Minister Blair is saying.
And is it a war you think we can win?
This is a war I hope we can win. It's not going to be as easy as a lot of the commentators think. It's going to be a very, very long haul.
Thank you, Major Charles Heyman.
Okay.
Charles Heyman is a former major in the British Army and editor of Jane's World Army publication. Yesterday, a suicide attacker drove a hijacked government jeep loaded with explosives into the State Assembly building in Kashmir, killing at least 29 people. The world's focus is on Afghanistan and the search for Osama bin Laden, but right next door is a powder keg that could, if everyone's not careful, take conflict in a far corner of the world to a terrifying new plane. What if Pakistan's own fundamentalists should come to power in chaos and find their finger on the nuclear trigger? What if India felt compelled to preempt that scenario? And always a fuse burns in Kashmir. Are we setting into motion a new domino effect in South Asia? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Joining us is William Clark. He was ambassador to India in President George H. Bush's administration. Good evening, Ambassador Clark.
Good evening.
Good to have you. Also with us are Stephen Cohen, senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Good evening, Stephen Cohen.
Good evening to you.
And our news analyst, Jack Beattie, joins us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Hello, Jack.
Hi.
I want to start with Stephen Cohen, if we may. Set the table for us, Stephen Cohen. Give us the India-Pakistan angle on the current crisis. How is it seen from each of these big powers just to the east of Afghanistan, and what are the great vulnerabilities there?
Let me say first that I think there's a unique opportunity now in South Asia, if not to bring peace between India and Pakistan, but at least to calm their conflict down somewhat. The Pakistanis have seen Pakistanis for many years have seen a major grievance with India, in that they argue that Kashmir was stolen from them, that Kashmiri people have been oppressed, and so forth. They couldn't do much about that until 1989, when there was an uprising of the Kashmiri people, and then Pakistan began to support the Kashmiris, but also began to feed in people from Pakistan, Afghanistan, and even further afield. In fact, one suicide bomber farmer was a British citizen. The Indians see Kashmir as theirs, that they believe that when the Maharaja of Kashmir acceded to India, then that under the rules of the game of partition, that Kashmir belonged to them. And they also argue that dividing Kashmir on the basis of religion would be giving into what the Pakistanis have called the two-nation theory, and that is dividing people on the basis of religion. The Indians, you know, fundamentally, the Indians are trying to preserve a secular state where religion does not define identity or citizenship. The Pakistanis would favor, you know, Pakistan was founded on the principle of a religious state as a homeland for Indian Muslims.
And so do we hear you saying that somehow in this crisis there's a chance for resolution of the Kashmir problem?
I think so. I think sometimes these awful events trigger room for diplomacy, and I think that's the case within Afghanistan, where America in particular could take the lead in fulfilling some of the obligations that it neglected many years ago, 10 years ago or more. And I think in South Asia there's an opportunity now for creative American diplomacy and international diplomacy, because the Pakistanis have suddenly become dependent on the Americans, and you know, we've reestablished a relationship with Islamabad, and the Indians and the United States have really developed a close relationship over the past 3 or 4 years. And this puts America in a position to subtly and quietly, I think, to begin to bridge the gap, and particularly to urge the two countries to start the process of dialogue and summitry that was begun in Simla in 1971, but most recently in Agra.
So here's another way that the chessboard is changing. But yet, right next door to Kashmir, we now have military forces that are assembling, moving toward Afghanistan, a sense that the Taliban may go. And if we understand correctly, some fear that the government of Pakistan itself could be vulnerable in the aftershock of any kind of intervention there. Ambassador William Clark, what's your sense on the Pakistan front of its vulnerability to whatever may happen in Afghanistan and how that might ripple through to India?
Well, clearly you have difficulties, and I agree with Steve to a large extent. But in Pakistan, you've seen the video of the people supporting Osama in the northern areas where the Pashtuns are. You've got a large body of Pashtuns in Pakistan. You have had...
That is the dominant group in Afghanistan.
Yeah, they're 42% of the population of Afghanistan, and almost 100% of the ruling Taliban.
So there's a sense of brotherhood across that border. So if we intervene, what does it mean?
Well, there's not only a sense of brotherhood. There's really a sense that there's no border. You go back and forth, and if someone is stopped, he says, "I'm going to see my uncle." Mm-hmm. I've always gone to see my uncle. Mm-hmm. And so it is an ill-defined area that the British were never able to do much with. Certainly the Russians didn't do much with it. But it puts a great deal of pressure on President Musharraf, because he has within his own army people who have helped train the Taliban and have worked with some of the other groups. He has a very fine line to walk here, to be an ally with the United States and help us, and yet to maintain his own position within his own country.
Stephen Cohen, so what are the risks here? If we intervene in Afghanistan, might we see Pakistan turning more fundamentalist?
I think on balance, no, because, of course, it depends how we intervene in Afghanistan. If the intervention in Afghanistan is seen as an American attack on Islam or an American attack on Afghanistan, then clearly there will be repercussions in Pakistan. But I don't think that's the way it has to be presented, and I don't think that's the way it should be. It should be seen as an attempt to liberate the Afghans from a very backward and dangerous regime that has not only hurt America through its support of Osama bin Laden, but also, I think, has inflicted great damage on Afghanistan itself. The ideal solution, and I think the solution that this administration may follow, is to have an international meeting on Afghanistan under UN auspices to try and get the Pakistanis, the Chinese, the Indians, the Iranians, the Russians, all to agree that Afghanistan should be a neutral country in the future, and the government in Afghanistan should be strong enough only to receive economic aid, and that would begin the process of reconstruction.
But Jack Beattie, you've seen the leader of Pakistan sweating bullets in his public appearances talking about this. He doesn't look too confident of this rational future.
No, but it's interesting. In the New York Times today, there was a quote from someone speaking for the silent majority in Pakistan who was saying, thank God for this U.S. intervention. It's saving us from our own Taliban, that there are forces within Pakistan, that is to say, that are not just the radical Islamicists, but middle-class people who don't want Talibanization.
We've got to take a quick break. Listeners, we're looking at the high-risk zone to the east of Afghanistan and what the impact of intervention in Afghanistan may be there in Pakistan and India. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. For background information on India, Pakistan, and the conflict in Kashmir, log on to our website, wbur.org, and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage of the Aftermath of Terror from WBUR, Boston. From WBUR Boston, this is Special Coverage of the Aftermath of Terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about India, Pakistan, and the disputed region of Kashmir. It's a hot-button region with a history of conflict and a nuclear arsenal. Will alliances with the West unleash violent unrest against, among, Islamic groups? Will alliances with the United States unleash more anti-American sentiment? And what are the regional risks of U.S. military intervention in Afghanistan? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Stephen Cohen, I want to turn to you for a moment. So we see that there's actually an opportunity here as the whole deck gets reshuffled for something good to come out of this, but yet we hear a lot of unease coming from the region as well. From the point of view of the subcontinent, what is the worst case scenario for our intervention in Afghanistan, and how can the administration act to avoid it?
I think the worst case, well, there are many worst case scenarios. That's the problem. This is, you're right in characterizing this as a very dangerous region. It's it's quite remarkable.
So fill us in. Give us some details that we might anticipate or hope to turn away from.
I think the worst case scenario, which is avertible, one would be that General Musharraf can't maintain control over his own army, that there are divisions in the army, that Pakistan lapses into civil war. This would provide opportunities for India to meddle into Pakistan. This could lead to response by the Pakistanis. You might have a conventional war, which could escalate to nuclear war. Our policy in Afghanistan would fail, and we'd also have a regional war of some consequence on our hands. I think that's the absolute worst-case scenario. I don't think that's going to happen, because I think that the crisis that Pakistan faces now is a crisis it would have had to face perhaps 5 or 6 years from now, and that is the battle between the moderates and the liberal Pakistanis and those who would like to drag Pakistan into a more confrontational and even ideologically motivated position, the Islamists and others. And I think that the army and Musharraf are in favor of a more moderate policy, partly because Pakistan is economically vulnerable. They really have no choice. A worst case scenario, I think, could be that if India began to use this as an opportunity to pressure Pakistan, Indians are concerned that the U.S. has developed a close relationship with Pakistan again. The Indians have always seen our relationship with Pakistan as directed against them, although I don't think that's been the case. And this existence of zero-sum thinking both in India and Pakistan really could lead one side to the other side to miscalculate and see this as a situation in which the regional balance of power is tilting against them. The Indian leadership has shown extraordinary patience and wisdom, I think, in this case, and we have Jaswant Singh, the foreign minister in Washington now. While they're concerned about America supporting Pakistan excessively, I think they understand that a stable Pakistan, a viable Pakistan, and a moderate Pakistan is in India's interest.
And Stephen Cohen, you've called the risk of nuclear war in South Asia serious and increasing. What is the state of nuclear readiness between India and Pakistan right now on the eve of whatever's coming?
Well, it's increasing because they both have nuclear weapons, but there's no evidence that I know of that they've actually deployed nuclear weapons or the nuclear weapons are on hair trigger alert. Mm-hmm. And certainly the Indians have made it quite clear that their weapons are not deployed and put in vulnerable positions. There's some concern, and an American team just visited Pakistan a few days ago, that if there should be turmoil in Pakistan, that somebody could grab one of the Pakistani nuclear weapons, or that a rogue Pakistani commander or general might take one and give it to militants or even to terrorists to use against either India or the United States. But I think that as long as Pakistan remains under military rule right now. I think that's unlikely. The military chain of command in Pakistan is pretty tight for the most part.
Mm. Listeners, we're looking at India, Pakistan, Kashmir, and the powder keg east of Afghanistan. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Sam is on the line. Welcome, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening. Hi. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
okay.
We're with you, Sam.
Here is the question. I guess we have guided missile, but misguided priorities. My question is specific.
Okay.
Now, the first thing we did to entice Pakistan to allow us to go to war through them is to say, hey, sanction lifted. You can go ahead with your nuke program. Perfect it. It's okay.
Lifting the U.S. sanctions.
Mm-hmm. My question then is, after the war, then what?
Mm-hmm. So thank you, Sam, for that question. Let me put that to you, Ambassador Clark. The United States has moved to lift some sanctions on Pakistan, including some that would let it refine its nuclear capacity. My understanding that was intended to give us more oversight or insight into that capacity. But Sam says once you've done that and the war's over, they've got that capacity, and then what?
Well, we have moved to lift the sanctions. There were sanctions on both India and Pakistan for their series of tests, but having lifted the sanctions does not mean that we will then sit idly by if they go back to testing and doing things of that nature. It's just not going to happen. What happens afterwards? Of course, we're going to have to work with them to assure that they don't move their nuclear programs forward. But at this particular point in time, that seems a reasonable assumption. So I think the government is right in lifting the sanctions on both. There are some sanctions that still remain on Pakistan, but the sanctions for their nuclear programs are being lifted at the same time the Indian sanctions are being lifted.
Mm. Stephen Cohen, I know we only have you for a couple of minutes more. What are the U.S. levers of influence? Both Pakistan and India have at different times seemed to be quite immune to U.S. pressure. Do we have greater leverage right now?
Well, I think they've been immune on issues where they think their vital national security interests are involved. And that was certainly the case of Pakistan and its nuclear weapons program, and I think it was in the case of India and its nuclear weapons program. Each country felt that they had to have some weapons capability or some potential weapons program in order to, for their vital national security interests, the same way the Israelis feel that they must have a nuclear weapons program. So I think that when a country takes that view of a policy, that no American pressure, no pressure by any country is going to dissuade them. I think we do, as Bill Clark said, I think we do have leverage over them in terms of developing nuclear weapon systems, which are provocative, dangerous, risky, because that actually affects our security. And we have a legitimate concern that their systems be under tight control, that they not be irresponsibly deployed, that they're under good management, that they don't leak nuclear materials to other countries or nuclear technology to other countries. In the light of the World Trade Center bombings, that becomes an even more serious problem.
Urgent, we'd say. Urgent. Stephen Cohen, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for joining us.
I'm happy to be with you, brother.
Listeners, we're looking at India, Pakistan, and the powder keg east of Afghanistan. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Mahesh is on the line. Welcome, Mahesh. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're very well, thanks.
Hi. My name is Mahesh. I'm an Indian national, and I have been a listener of this program. So I have a couple of points to make.
Okay, lay them on us.
The first point is that Pakistan itself has harbored a terrorist. So I think that Pakistan is not a trusted partner for the United States in the elimination of terrorists.
Let's put that to Ambassador William Clark. Ambassador Clark, we know that there have been indeed very close ties between Pakistan and the Taliban in Afghanistan. Now the word Taliban has become associated with terrorism. What do you think of Mahesh's point?
Well, Mahesh has a point. I mean, the Pakistan government was instrumental in aiding Taliban and in fact setting them up, and they've also had training camps for people that were going into Kashmir, and this is a definite problem that we're going to have to deal with. I mean, right now it appears that General Musharraf is moving in the right direction, but we're going to have to monitor it. It is very clear that there has been support from ISI, the
intelligence service
of Pakistan, helping out these groups, both in Afghanistan and in Kashmir, and that has to be dealt with. So he's quite right.
So when we begin to lean hard on the Taliban, which looks as though it may be imminent, what is your assessment of the stability of General Musharraf's military regime in Pakistan? We've seen the near riots in the streets, and we read, even south in Karachi, of tremendous anti-American sentiment. Is there a risk of that military government being overthrown, of an Islamic coup?
No, the risk would be, in my view, would be of a split in the military. And one of the things that certainly the British left behind in India, they left a united military that was apolitical. In Pakistan, it has been a united military that has felt it had to intervene in politics. But it has always remained united. If you look at the history of Pakistan, there have been, I think, three successful coups and five or six that weren't. The five or six that weren't were led by junior officers. The three that were successful were led by the Army Chief of Staff.
Well, it's a risk we don't want to take right now. Jack Beatty, we've got some glimmers of light here, but also some very grim scenarios indeed. Whoever knew that capturing Osama bin Laden would involve such risks?
Yeah, and when you think about those risks, I'm reminded of what George Kennan said after the Iranian Revolution, when our embassy in Tehran was overrun by radical students. He said the United States should declare war on Iran so that people would understand how grave an act it was to seize someone's embassy, and then do nothing because the risks were too great. And that's one feeling I have. And the other one is just to remember what an Afghan caller told us last week, that this very scenario is exactly what Osama bin Laden planned. He wants the intervention, he wants the forces based in Pakistan for the reasons we have been talking about. They could be a destabilizing element. He wants the intervention in Afghanistan, and that, in fact, in figuring out where to go from the Sudan, he picked the map that was the point on the map that was right above this powder keg we're talking about. And it's as if all our options here are bad. I think General Musharraf really has it right when he says any American intervention must be, quote, very, very short.
Listeners, what do you make of the powder keg next door to Afghanistan as we appear to be assembling forces to intervene in Afghanistan? We're at 1-800-423-8255. David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question, basically very American question, which is that
we take those here.
Okay, that's good, and it's based. It's a question about the bureaucracy of our own government and the ability of our own government. We've seen failures of the intelligence and diplomatic community several times over the last several decades, in China in the 40s, in Vietnam in the 50s and 60s, in Iran in the 70s. Why should we have confidence? Why should I, as an ordinary citizen, have confidence we're going to do anything better this time?
David, thanks for your call. The stakes are certainly high enough to ask that question. Let's put it to Ambassador William Clark. We have heard this evening that there may be some positive scenario here, but what about this issue of confidence? When the risks are so high, how can ordinary Americans feel confident that we've got a handle on this?
Region. Yeah, well, there are clearly no guarantees in this, but I think you can be confident in the team that has been put together in Washington. I know most of them, and these are not people that are going to go off in a cowboy fashion, if you will. We have, over the last few years, because of the mistakes of Vietnam, gotten to the point of trying to do quick fixes, whether it was bombing Kosovo from 30,000 feet or shooting missiles at Osama bin Laden and somebody else's pharmaceutical plant in Sudan. It has not led to a great deal of confidence. I think what you can look at this time is that the statement by the president that not that he can fix it in a hurry, but this is going to be a long, difficult operation. It's not going to be a war. It is going to be giving fair warning to if you harbor a terrorist that attacks us as we have been attacked, then there is culpability there. But I think in this case one can have confidence. But the caller has a point, and no government can make a guarantee. We're going into a situation like this. It's very dicey.
It's very clear, and the stakes are high. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Franklin is on the line from Randallstown, Maryland. Welcome, Franklin.
Well, thank you. My question is this. Since, you know, previously we know what happened with the situation with Bangladesh before Bangladesh's independence.
You mean the civil war and conflict there breaking off from Pakistan?
Exactly. I'm saying if the pro-militant Muslim part is geographically separated in some way from the pro-Western part, why wouldn't they use that, you know, why couldn't the, you know, Indians, why wouldn't it, would the Indians be likely to try to do something similar to that, to divide Pakistan, you know,
sure,
based on those lines? And I'm wondering, what could the United States do to you know, kind of convince them that wouldn't be a good idea to try to instigate something like that?
Franklin, it's a good question, and we heard earlier this evening, here's the risk of some kind of split in Pakistan, whether in the government or even, as Franklin suggests, geographically. Ambassador William Clark, do you see that risk? And if things begin to get hot, do we have enough influence over these governments and scenes to keep a lid on it?
Well, you know, the question is well put. The difference being, however, that at the time of the Bangladesh War, Pakistan was really two nations. And, in fact, the leader of Bangladesh had won an election for president and wasn't going to get the job. So that there was a rebellion going on in the eastern portion of the country, which was not connected to the western side at all, and they're very different populations. In the case of Pakistan as it exists today, I think the risk of its splitting are very low. The risk of some splits within the government, however, is something you really have to pay attention to, and particularly a split within the army. I don't think that's terribly possible, but it's something you have to keep an eye on.
And William Clark, you were ambassador to India. What are you hearing from your friends and contacts there? What's the level of tension and concern in India?
Well, the concern in India, I mean, is I think we have now a better relationship with India than we did when I was there, quite frankly. We've been working on it. The Clinton administration, the visit to India was very good. It was the first president to visit since Jimmy Carter. And that was very positive. The new government, BJP, which
yes,
is a Hindu party, we have worked with them. In fact, Jaswant Singh is in Washington right now.
But when they look across their borders and see the conflict brewing to their west,
mm-hmm,
well?
No, I think the Indians do not have any intention of trying to play around in troubled waters in Pakistan, which is, I think, where your question is leading. But on the other hand, they do want to move forward with settling Kashmir, which they see as Pakistani intervention in their territory. So it is a very difficult position for the Indians. At this point, I think they're on the right track and moving in the right direction.
Let's hope so. Jack Beatty, last thoughts?
Well, the CIA, an earlier caller, raised the question of our competence. And last year, the Atlantic Monthly ran an article in which the former case officer said he couldn't find any Islamic, any Pashtun speakers in the Near East Division. And another officer told him operations that include diarrhea as a way of life don't happen. This doesn't fill me with great confidence about the CIA in that part of the world.
We'll be watching closely as armies gather around Afghanistan and these neighbors. Thank you very much, Ambassador William Clark, for joining us this evening.
Adol, thank you.
William Clark was ambassador to India in the George H. Bush administration. Thanks also to you, Jack Beatty, for being on board.
Thank you.
Earlier, we spoke with Stephen Cohen, senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. You can continue the conversation online. Go to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage of the aftermath of terror from WBUR, Boston. From WBUR in Boston, this is special coverage of the aftermath of terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. In the days after September 11, President Bush took the lead in framing the world's dialogue on the war on terrorism. Today, Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair took up the mantle and the battle cry. Speaking at a Labour Party conference in Brighton, England, the Prime Minister pledged victory over terror in an impassioned address that was uplifting and upped the ante. We're going to take the time now to hear how Prime Minister Blair prepared his country for war. We'll follow that with a discussion with our news analyst Jack Beattie. Here are excerpts from today's speech.
In retrospect, the millennium marked a moment in time, but it was the events of the 11th of September that marked a turning point in history, where we confront the dangers of the future and assess the choices facing humankind. I met some of the families of the British victims, and it was in many ways a very British occasion. Tea and biscuits raining outside and around the edge of the room, strangers making small talk, trying to be normal people in a very abnormal situation. And then a middle-aged mother looks you in the eyes and tells you that her only son has died and asks you why. And I tell you, you do not feel like the most powerful man in the country at times like that, because there is no answer. There is no justification for the pain of those people. Her son did nothing wrong. The woman, 7 months pregnant, whose child will never know its father, did nothing wrong. And they don't want revenge. They want something better in memory of their loved ones. And I believe that their memorial can and should be greater than simply the punishment of the guilty. It is that out of the shadow of this evil should emerge lasting good. Destruction of the machinery of terrorism wherever it is found. Hope amongst all nations of a new beginning where we seek to resolve differences in a calm and ordered way. Greater understanding between nations and between faiths. And above all, justice and prosperity for the poor and dispossessed, so that people everywhere can see the chance of a better future through the hard work and creative power of the free citizen, not the violence and savagery of the fanatic. Be in no doubt at all. Bin Laden and his people organized this atrocity. The Taliban aid and abet him. He will not desist from further acts of terror. They will not stop helping him. Whatever the dangers of the action we take, the dangers of inaction are far, far greater. Look for a moment at the Taliban regime. It is undemocratic, that goes without saying. There's no sport allowed, or television, or photography. No art or culture is permitted. All other faiths, all other interpretations of Islam are ruthlessly suppressed. Those who practice their faith are imprisoned. Women are treated in a way almost too revolting to be credible. First driven out of university, girls not allowed to go to school, no legal rights, unable to go out of doors without a man, those that disobey are stoned. There is now no contact permitted with Western agencies, even those delivering food. The people live in abject poverty. It is a regime founded on fear and funded by the drugs trade. So what do we do? Don't overreact, some say. We aren't. We haven't lashed out. No missiles on the first night just for effect. Don't kill innocent people. We are not the ones who wage war on the innocent. We seek the guilty. Look for a diplomatic solution. But there is no diplomacy with Bin Laden or the Taliban regime. State an ultimatum and get their response. We stated the ultimatum. They haven't responded. Understand the causes of terror. Yes, we should try. But let there be no moral ambiguity about this. Nothing could ever justify the events of 11th of September, and it is to turn justice on its head to pretend it could. The action that we take will be proportionate, targeted. We will do all we humanly can to avoid civilian casualties, but understand what we are dealing with. They have no moral inhibition on the slaughter of the innocent. If they could have murdered not 7,000, but 70,000, does anyone doubt they would have done so and rejoiced in it? So there is no compromise possible with such people. There's no meeting of minds, no point of understanding with such terror. Just a choice. Defeat it or be defeated by it. And defeat it we must. Any action taken will be against the terrorist network of Bin Laden. As for the Taliban, they can surrender the terrorists or face the consequences. And I say to the Taliban, surrender the terrorists or surrender power. That is your choice. The 11th of September is bringing government and people to reflect, consider, and change. And in this process, amidst all the talk of war, there is another dimension appearing. There is a coming together. The power of community is asserting itself. We are realizing how fragile are our frontiers in the face of the world's new challenges. Today, conflicts rarely stay within national boundaries. Today, a tremor in one financial market is repeated in the markets of the world. Today, confidence is global, its presence or its absence. Today, the threat is chaos, because for people with work to do and family life to balance and mortgages to pay and careers to further, pensions to provide, the yearning is for order and stability. And if it doesn't exist elsewhere, it's unlikely to exist here. I have long believed that this interdependence defines the new world we live in. You know, people say, well, we're only acting because it's the USA that was attacked. Double standards, they say. But when Milosevic embarked on the ethnic cleansing of Muslims in Kosovo, we acted. And I tell you that if Rwanda happened again today, as it did in 1993, when a million people were slaughtered in cold blood, we would have a moral duty to act there also. We can't do it all. Neither can the Americans. But, you know, the power of the international community could, together, if it chose to, it could, with our help, sort out the blight that is the continuing conflict in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where 3 million people have died through war or famine in the last decade. A partnership for Africa between the developed and developing world based around the New African Initiative. It's there to be done if we find the will. On our side, provide more aid, untied to trade. Write off debt, help with good governance and infrastructure. Training to the soldiers with UN blessing in conflict resolution. Encouraging investment and access to our markets so that we practice the free trade we're so fond of preaching. The state of Africa is a scar on the conscience of the world. But if the world as a community focused on it, we could heal it. We could defeat climate change, if we chose to. Kyoto is right. We will implement it and call upon all other nations to do so. And if we wanted to, we could breathe new life into the Middle East peace process, and we must. The critics will say, but how can the world be a community? Nations act in their own self-interest. Of course they do. But what is the lesson of the financial markets, climate change, international terrorism, nuclear proliferation, or world trade? It is that our self-interest and our mutual interests are today inextricably woven together. The issue is how we use the power of community to combine globalization with justice. If globalization works only for the benefit of the few, then it will fail, and it will deserve to fail. But if we follow the principles that have served us here so well at home, that power, wealth, and opportunity must be in the hands of the many, not the few, if we make that our guiding light for the global economy, then it will be a force for good and an international movement we should take pride in leading.
Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking today at a Labour Party conference in Brighton, England. It was quite a speech, Jack Beattie, don't you think?
Yes, here's the vision that we've been looking for. With President Bush, I think we made a state. He stepped in that direction. But this, for the first time, was a reminder that this crisis is also an opportunity, and that the people who died shan't have died in vain if something lasting and good can come out of this. And the Prime Minister went down the list. Humanitarian interventions in places where slaughters are going on, mm-hmm. a program of development for the wretched of the earth, combining globalization with justice such that the many benefit and not just the few. This is the promise of this moment. And he has stepped up to it, it seems to me, and really made me think that something good can come out of this.
Big themes. We saw President Bush's speech rallying the nation and showing that we were going to be pugnacious, tough, and not intimidated 2 weeks ago. And now Tony Blair also having strong elements of that. I mean, they were showing muscle and iron here. But then, as you say, bringing it together with this call to for the community of nations to work on the world's problems. Jack, do you get the feeling that this speech was partly addressed to the unilateralists still, we know, active within the Bush administration?
I don't think there's any question about it. When he comes out and says we must make progress on Kyoto, Kyoto is right. Well, of course, the Bush administration rejected Kyoto, mm-hmm. that is to say the protocols on global warming. When he talked about development aid in the third world, this is something that the United States has not really made a priority. When he talked about the whole idea of mutuality and the interwoven nature of globalization, he is drawing our attention to what is the reality that there is a politics of globalization. It doesn't just have to be an economic process, a blind economic run that we have no control over. There's also a politics, and that is the politics of the world community joining together in the name now of fighting terrorism, but in a broader cause that he talks about.
It's interesting. Here, I guess, comes the fascinating quid pro quo for the Bush administration, which had always wanted to go it alone. Tony Blair has stood up from the very beginning of this crisis, was on the floor of the U.S. Congress on the night of President Bush's speech, practically wrapped the Union Jack and the American flag together. But now comes Tony Blair's other message. Hey, George Bush, yes, we're with you, and we'll even act with you militarily, but it's going to be in a more in a community of nations kind of effort. Is this, Jack, the long-awaited new world order in embryo form?
Yeah, I'm wondering about that. I mean, we heard that phrase first from President George Bush Sr. after the Gulf War. And, of course, shortly thereafter, when a crisis for world order came about in Yugoslavia, he said to one of his subordinates, well, tell me again why I need to pay attention to Yugoslavia. And, of course, a vast slaughter unfolded that took us years to intervene and stop. And then in the Clinton administration, when the Rwanda genocide came about, the Clinton administration wouldn't even send a plane there to block the hateful radio broadcasts that were stoking the genocide. So two tremendous failures of global order. Blair is saying, well, we can make it work. We have to make it work. And he even revisited both those failures of global order. And he's sort of reminding us that unless we take steps to stop violence, the violence will come back at us. Mm.
And a lot of big talk about both bread and bombs. Yet in the past, Britain and the U.S. have walked away from Afghanistan and Pakistan when it came time to deliver the bread.
Yes, he says elsewhere in the speech, we will not walk away as the outside world has done so many times before. He says this to the Afghan people, and yet, of course, the United States essentially funded a civil war in Afghanistan, and then walked away from Pakistan, which we had supplied, which had been our conduit to that war, and just washed our hands of that region of the world, as of course we washed our hands of the Congo. As the great power politics has littered the world with these powder kegs, and he's sort of saying we're not going to make those mistakes again, because this isn't just a matter of altruism; our own self-interest is involved.
And behind the talk of altruism tonight and throughout this day, you have the sense of the military forces that are converging around Afghanistan. The talk at the end was peace and community, but there's a military piece to this too.
He says we will put a trap around their regime, and the trap is closing.
Mm. That was Prime Minister Tony Blair's speech today in Brighton, England. For a transcript and audio of the Prime Minister's address to the Labour Party earlier today, go to our website, wbur.org, and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage of the aftermath of terror from WBUR Boston.